I declare bankruptcy!
I congratulate you on your imagination, but this is a court of space law, not a theater.
Fax mentis incendium gloria calpum etc etc memo bis punitor delicatum. It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal.
How is this a fair trial? Our lawyer is a Morty.
It's not fair. You have no rights, and he's not a lawyer. We just keep him here because he's fun. Look at him go.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 143. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your other host, Andrew Torres. How you doing, Señor Torres?
Muy bien, gracias.
Excellent. This is an all-Spanish episode. Is that the extent of your Spanish?
I can ask where the library is.
Yeah, everyone remembers biblioteca. You can't forget the word biblioteca. But yes, all right, another episode, another chance to mention that we are doing the Patreon live Q&A on Wednesday. That is, as you're hearing this, probably tomorrow. And that's going to be at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. I'm sure the Q&A thread is up as we speak. Make sure, if you are a patron, a fine, fine patron, I might add, get over to that thread, ask your questions, vote on other questions. It'll be fun. It's one of the best things we do here. And, of course, Lot Awful Movies coming at those $2 and up patrons very soon. Excited for that.
If you ask a cop if he's a cop, he's, like, obligated to tell you. It's in the Constitution.
Constitution of America?
Huh. So go ahead and ask.
You a cop?
All right. And speaking of excitement, we have some sovereign citizen fun coming up here. Andrew, the sovereign citizens are at it again. What is it this time?
So this is a story of New Hampshire HB 1653. This got some press, including an article in the Daily Beast. But I want to tell you, it is crazier than you think. It is worse than the press it has gotten. So what is this bill? This bill was written by a New Hampshire state legislature named Dick Marple. Great name. And he is 85 years old. And I want to be totally fair here. He is a crazy person. Okay. This is the bill. And I'm just going to read the bill because I think I would not do justice if I don't. It's just a short bill. Section 1, Statement of Findings. The General Court finds that the protocol of the Uniform Commercial Code, as adopted in RSA 382-A, requires all corporations to disclose all elements of any contract being offered. All right, that seems fine, right? Rampant non-disclosure is a fault that must be addressed by the General Court. That's insane. It's not the case that there is rampant non-disclosure under the UCC, unless what you mean is somebody using the UCC to file fraudulent and frivolous instruments claiming billion-dollar debts against the government for presentment indictments and stuff like that. But this bill specifies the disclosure that they think is rampant, right? The non-disclosure that they think is rampant that must be remedied. Section 2, disclosure of contract terms required. And then subsection Roman numeral 1, all contracts with sovereign, quote, inhabitants, end quote, defined under Part 2, Article 30 of the New Hampshire Constitution, and sojourners in this republic shall have all elements of any contract being offered fully and completely disclosed and explained, particularly those contracts involving an ens legis or straw man, as commonly referred.
Oh, there it is. Meet your straw man, everybody.
Yeah, we did Lord Awful Movies number 13. We watched Meet Your Straw Man. The word, I want to be very, very clear on this. So ens legis is Latin for legally created thing, right? I had to look that up, even though you can kind of figure it out by Latin, and I knew enough Latin to know legis means law, like, you know, legislate. Mm. But nevertheless, it is not a common legal term. It has not been used since, you know, the 17th century. The word straw man is only a crazy person, sovereign citizen term. It is not a legal term. It has no, when you say as commonly referred, you mean as commonly
it's not,
referred.
It's not like it's a normal term, but they just kind of, you know, they use it a different way. That's so you're saying that is fundamentally sovereign citizen nonsense.
Insane. And again, if you didn't have the good fortune of hearing Meet Your Straw Man, the idea
available
is that,
at fine Patreon stores everywhere. Or just on patreon.com/law.
Yeah. So it continues. A sovereign inhabitant will be harmed by any unrevealed element if such inhabitant does not reserve his or her rights under RSA 382-A subsection 1-103 and RSA 382-A subsection 1-308. Those, I should tell you, these citations are citations to the Uniform Commercial Code as applied in New Hampshire. It's they're nonsense cites. Therefore, if these two citations are to be included above the signature line on the contract with the words all rights reserved or without prejudice, RSA 382-A 1-306, RSA 382-A 1-103, UCC 1-103, UCC 1-308, Roman numeral 2. The failure of any corporation to provide full disclosure of all elements of every contract as required by paragraph 1 shall result in the forfeiture of $10,000 to the state treasury. If a municipal corporation funded by the state fails to make such disclosure, the forfeiture of $10,000 will be a set-off from that entity's funding received from the state. Effective date shall take effect 60 days after passage. I want to be very clear on this. This bill has been introduced in the New Hampshire state legislature. This bill has 14 other co-sponsors in the New Hampshire state legislature. Will it surprise you to learn that all 15 of the co-sponsors of HB 1653 are Republicans?
Who knows? I mean, I won't say I'm so partisan as to assume Democrats could never fall into this nonsense, but it does seem to be a Republican libertarian-y thing.
All 15 are Republicans, and I want to be charitable. I have to assume some of them are just lazy and not insane.
Yeah, charitably, they're just lazy.
Right. And again, this is not, I know we get the you're too political XYZ. Democrats are not organized sovereign citizens by and large. I do not know of any Democratic legislator that is introducing stuff like that in any state legislature anywhere. I do not know of any Democrats that have signed on to bills like this. I'm sure we can find a couple of, you know, crackpots that I like. Lyndon LaRouche used to identify as a Democrat and he was a crazy person. But nevertheless, this is something that dovetails with and is encouraged by the most extreme elements in the Republican Party. It completely overlaps with the, small government arch libertarian. I'm a sovereign citizen upon the land. The rhetoric is not far apart. So there you have it. We're going to keep our eyes, you know, we're going to keep tracking HB 1653. I don't think it's going to pass. Uh-huh. But I want to be clear. Right. We know how sovereign citizens use the words corporation. Right. And this has municipal corporation in it. This means that contracts with the city, if they don't fully explain sovereign citizen nonsense and include the specific verbiage, that those city organizations, if this bill passes, will be required to pay $10,000 in penalties to the state per violation. And I want to be doubly clear, the way in which this happens is, and again, listen to Law and Awful Movies 13, listen to our back episodes on sovereign citizens. These people, when they are sovereign citizens, when they are caught up in the criminal justice system, file these frivolous writs and presentments and instruments that make no sense against the government and say, I demand that you show me X. And if you don't show me X within 12 days, you will owe me $1 billion at law. And they file it as a UCC-1 statement, which is a secured financing statement. And then they come into court and go, look, they didn't provide this within 12 days. So according to this UCC-1, they owe me $12 billion or $1 billion. Right. This is what they do. They're then surprised. So if Dick Marple is listening to this episode, he's going to be very, very surprised when he does this thing. And then the court says, you know, we're not giving you your $1 billion. But somehow they never seem deterred by the fact that they never get their $1 billion. So anyway, I just wanted to go back to the wonderful, wacky world of sovereign citizens. And this is a timely, the bill was just introduced. It's out there. We laugh at these people, but these people, this guy holds public office.
Yep.
Yeah. So there you go. Anyway, HB 1653, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, it really is depressing. The number of conspiracy theory politician. It's not just like, oh, this is a guy in his basement somewhere. It's like, no, this is an elected official. Awesome.
It dovetails with, we got an email from Wes Jensen. I want to give him a shout out. He sent, I'm going to link it in the show notes, an article called Hiding Behind the Bar. And it is delightful.
This sounds like
something
sovereign
citizen nonsense. Oh. I'm going to read the money quote. A bar licensed attorney's sworn duty is to transfer your ownership's rights, titles, and allegiance to the landowner. When you hire a bar attorney to represent you in their courts, you have hired an officer of that court whose sole purpose and occupation is to transfer what you have to the creator and authority of that court. A more appropriate phrase would be legal plunder. So apparently, I didn't know I was doing that, but apparently that's what happens if you
engage
me as a lawyer.
Okay. Well, boy, I can't wait to get, you know, admitted to be able to do some legal plunder.
Yeah, Thomas takes the legal plunder exam. Yeah. There we go.
Okay.
So check it out.
Awesome. All right, Andrew, for our main segment today, we're going to talk about a very interesting case. I haven't researched myself, so I am a student on this show. I can't wait to educate us on this birthright citizenship for same-sex couples case. Really fascinating. Break it down for us.
Okay. So let's start with the basic proposition, right? And that proposition is the first sentence of the 14th Amendment, which says, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Right. And we talk about the 14th Amendment a lot. All of the stuff that you think about as being in the 14th Amendment, right, is all in the first clause, but it's the second sentence, right? It is the no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privilege or immunities of the citizens of the United States or deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor denied any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, right? Those clauses are the ones that are litigated all the time. The citizenship clause isn't frequently litigated. And, I mention all of this because if you have an Uncle Frank in your life who is unhappy about birthright citizenship, who complains about anchor babies, and look, there was a serious movement among the Tea Party of the right to end birthright citizenship.
Yeah, well, you know, in fairness, as mm-hmm. you know, as much as we have our slant, I was surprised to find out that this is an uncommon thing in the world. Mm-hmm. I think that most countries, if I'm not mistaken, don't have that. So kind of interesting. It's not as though this is something every country does and the evil Republicans want to get rid of it. I don't think it's like a ridiculous argument, given that so many other countries don't have this birthright law, you know, to look at.
I think you make a really, really good point in that we could certainly debate the merits thereof in terms of, and also the practice. I think where it becomes inconsistent is when you claim to revere the Constitution and the founding fathers very clearly had this.
Oh, well, they can do no wrong. So, that's true.
You cannot, if you've got somebody who uses the phrase anchor baby and they have, you know, proud lover of the Constitution in their Twitter handle, you could read sentence one of the 14th Amendment. But as with all legal principles, it's never quite as simple as the principles that are enshrined in the Constitution and the supporting amendments, right? So what does it mean to be born in the United States, right? And you would think like that's super easy, but in fact, we have a statute. It's 8 U.S.C. 1401 that defines what it means to be born in the United States. And it starts off pretty straightforwardly, right? So subsection A says it's a person born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. That just repeats the language from the 14th Amendment. Then it says, subsection B, a person born in the United States to a member of an Indian, Eskimo, Aleutian, or other Aboriginal tribe, provided that the granting of citizenship under this subsection shall not in any manner impair or otherwise affect the right of such person to tribal or other property. And now you can see that we need to have that subsection B because the 14th Amendment says subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And if you are born on a tribal reservation that has Native American sovereignty, you might face the argument that you are not subject to the jurisdiction thereof, right? And the degree to which you are is a very complex set of overlapping factors. But in order to make sure that that was not precluded by law, they added subsection B to the statute to say, yeah, no, this also includes members of Aboriginal tribes. But now ask the question, what about Americans who study or travel abroad, right? Thomas, you and Lydia, let's say you decide, you take baby Phoebe, you go overseas and you study for 2 years in France. You've lived in the United States the rest of your life. You're both U.S. citizens. You're over there. You intend to come back. You love this country. You know, your co-host is an American lawyer, all that stuff. And you have another child while you're in France, right? So, well, in an era of travel, right? And this is, I think this dovetails with, you know, your point on kind of the archaic notion of being, you know, tied to the land. In an era of international travel, we wouldn't want to say like, oh gosh, we want pregnant women to get on a plane and fly back home, right? Like that, you know, all sorts of, so we added a whole bunch of additional subsections under 1401 that cover situations that are kind of like that. And for purposes of this litigation, I'm going to read subsection G, which is a person born outside the geographical limits of the United States and its outlying possessions, of parents, one of whom is an alien and the other a citizen of the United States, who, prior to the birth of such person, was physically present in the United States or its outlying possessions for a period or periods totaling not less than 5 years, at least two of which were after attaining the age of 14 years. Okay, so there's a lot of like lawyering in those clauses, but this is the provision that allows my buddy Ted Cruz to be an American citizen.
Let's get rid of it. Oh, sorry.
Ted Cruz was born. He was born in Alberta, Canada, to a couple, a U.S. citizen, his mom, and a non-citizen, his dad. His dad was not naturalized until 2005. Ted Cruz was born in 1970. So at the time, his citizenship extended and he was considered a person born in the United States under 8 U.S.C.
Born in the United
1401
States.
G.
He's born in Canada.
It is considered, that I know this seems weird, to qualify for born in the United States under the 14th Amendment.
Oh, okay.
It includes born outside the United States to U.S. citizens traveling abroad.
Okay,
and gotcha. So Ted Cruz is considered born in the United States. Now, I want to add, because this may come up again in future presidential elections, this does not mean to be eligible to be president, there is a separate clause that is natural born citizen. Mm. This statute would not help define that provision. That's going to have to be a separate episode. So next time Ted Cruz declares his candidacy for the presidency, which will happen.
Yeah,
we will tackle what it means to be a natural born citizen. But I just wanted to flag that as an issue right now. The statute passed in the 20th century cannot tell us what the founding fathers meant by natural born citizen. But there's no question, right? Like as much as I don't want Ted Cruz to be president, and as much as there may be an argument that he's not a natural born citizen and is thus not eligible to be president, there's no question he's a citizen, right? Like he's a U.S. citizen, and he's a U.S. citizen by operation of this G provision, right? And that is, go over it again, one parent who's a citizen living abroad, one parent who is a citizen living abroad, and that parent was previously physically present in the United States for at least 5 years, of which at least two were after the age of 14. So that's the compromise that the legislature came up with to say, you're really a U.S. resident and you're just staying abroad, as opposed to you are not a U.S. resident. You only had a tenuous connection. Now, I want to take that exact same fact pattern and I want to change it just a teeny tiny bit. And we're going to delete Ted Cruz's parents and we're going to replace that with different names. Mm-hmm. And that's all we're going to do. So the first case is the Blixt case. Allison Blixt is a United States citizen. She was born and raised in this country. She has lived here for over 20 years. She is married to Stefania Zakari, who is an Italian citizen. They were living in London when Allison and Stefania underwent in vitro fertilization and they conceived their children. And like many lesbian couples, they used their own eggs and sperm from an unknown donor. They both got pregnant. So Stefania gave birth to a son named Lucas. Allison gave birth to a son named Massey. The INS is saying that Massey is a U.S. citizen and Lucas is not. For reasons that I'm about to explain. Now, again, let's go back to Ted Cruz. Just like Ted Cruz, Lucas was, one, born outside the U.S., two, of parents, one of whom is an alien and the other of whom is a citizen, and three, the citizen was physically present in the U.S. for at least 5 years, including two over the age of 14. No different.
Are they married or did you?
Yeah, they are. Oh, okay. They are married. They were legally married at the time.
Gotcha.
Good clarifying question, right? The second is the DeVosh Banks case, and not lesbians, gay men, but exactly the same thing. So Andrew DeVosh Banks is a U.S. citizen, born and raised in this country, lived here for 24 plus years. His husband is Elad DeVosh Banks, who's an Israeli citizen. And they were living in London at the time. Their twin sons are Ethan and Aiden. And in a pretty near analog of the Blixt situation, Andrew and Elad used their own sperm, and then they used eggs from the same anonymous donor. So Elad's sperm was used to conceive Ethan, and Andrew's sperm was used to conceive Aiden. Hmm. And then a surrogate, they're twins. A surrogate carried the twins together term in the womb and gave birth to them moments apart, right? So they are fraternal twins born at virtually the same time, same mother, same womb, same birth mother, surrogate host, same womb. INS considers Aiden a U.S. citizen and Ethan not.
Wow.
So how the hell could that be the case, right?
Yeah.
Because we've just, right, again, we could go through the same thing. It you know, it seems pretty clear with the 8 U.S.C. 1401. And the answer is that INS applied a different statute. They applied a statute, 8 U.S.C. 1409. That statute is entitled Out of Wedlock. And it says, the provision of paragraph G of section 1401, the one that we're talking about, shall apply to a person, to birth of a person born out of wedlock if, and here are the criteria, one, a blood relationship between the person and the father is established by clear and convincing evidence. Two, the father had the nationality of the United States at the time of the person's birth. Three, the father in writing agrees to provide financial support until the person reaches 18. And four, while the person is under the age of 18, the person is legitimated under the law of the person's residence, the father acknowledges the paternity of the person in writing or under oath, or the paternity is established in court.
So they're saying since the egg donor or since the sperm donors in these situations are not married to the couples, this is an out of wedlock for one of them. It's out of wedlock because the one in each case, one member of the married couple is not a citizen. So how that's operating?
You are half right. You've given them too much credit. So the second half of what you said is correct, right? So it is the application of that A2 standard, right? They are saying the father of the children for whom the citizenship is disputed by the INS is not a citizen. So that is, in fact, the reason for saying twins could come out of the same womb and one would be a U.S. citizen and one would not be, which, you know, is if you think about it, I mean, as an absurd an example as you could possibly come up with, right? If I gave that to you as a bar exam question, you would immediately eliminate that answer. But the reason is not that the gay couple was not married to the surrogate mother or not entirely. It has to do with Appendix E of the Foreign Affairs Manual of Immigration and Naturalization Services.
Oh, man.
And that Appendix E says as follows.
So hold on. What you're saying is, I think the answer is, it's not just bigotry. It's really studious bigotry. Like they really had to go into that appendix to find just how to screw over some people. Okay.
And it says, and there are five provisions, A, B, C, D. A says, the term birth in wedlock has been consistently interpreted to mean birth during the marriage of the biological parents to each other. B, this includes a child conceived before the marriage but born during the marriage. C, to say a child was born in wedlock means that the child's biological parents were married to each other at the time of the birth of the child. And then DNE or termination that don't particularly apply.
They're looking at technically, biologically, who's the parent. So that's why the donor, I guess, is how they're saying that's not a sit. So it's they weren't married. So therefore that applies.
That's right. And so now I want us to play this out a little bit. Okay. The first thing is it would be trivially easy to apply this to any number of heterosexual couples, right? That undergo that undergo surrogacy.
Yeah.
Right? So, and I can tell you, as far as I know, this rule has never been interpreted against a particular
right. What are the odds? Until now, whoops! Oh, we just found this out when it's gay couples.
But I gotta say this, I want to say this in terms of full disclosure. This provision was added to Appendix E on July 8th, 2014.
Oh, okay.
CT Con-521. This is not a Trump era amendment. It is a Trump era enforcement, but nevertheless, the person who added this to the manual, and we don't know who it is for reasons that I'm about to explain, added it under Obama. This is one of the things that we have mentioned.
Well, you say added to the manual, so I know this is a wider conversation. So this isn't like a law so much as a guideline that an agency is allowed to figure out for itself because of the reasons we've talked about a bunch of times.
That is exactly right. Okay. So this is the internal guidance that the agency is using to determine whether to apply 1401G in wedlock or 1409, which again is expressly titled out of wedlock.
Boy.
And so they look to their manual. I should add, and I don't want to go super down the rabbit hole of the differing layers of administrative agency determinations. This is the most minimal action that an agency can take, right? This is an amendment to an appendix of an internal manual.
Yeah.
And importantly, it is not, we've talked about how formal agency determinations, right? Like the net neutrality order, you have to subject that to a period of notice and comment, right? You have to make it public. This was almost impossible for me to find. I'm going to give a link in the show notes, but it was really, really hard for me to find it. It has never been subject to notice and comment. As far as I can tell, it is a staffer who wrote this and stuck it in there in 2014. And
I have this fear now. Is this going to be Chevron deference biting liberals in the ass? Is that what this is going to be?
It well could be.
With the exception
here, though, I'm glad you flagged that, because that was one of the things that I wanted to say. You know, you take the good and you take the bad with Chevron deference, right? Like we've said, look, Chevron deference was never intended to be a liberal policy maneuver. It is intended to be a separation of powers maneuver. In this case, I don't think Chevron deference is going to win the day, because ultimately the question of the authority of the agency is going to be circumscribed by fundamental constitutional.
Yeah, rights. It does sound very constitutional. So
yeah, and that will trump the agency's internal determination. I think it is really, really clear from both the Obergefell decision in 2015 and also the immediately prior case on gay marriage, which was U.S. v. Windsor, which involved a Canadian couple that was married in Canada, which had legally recognized gay marriage in 2013, and overturned that provision of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act in the United States, and said that the United States is required to recognize and accord the full benefits of a valid marriage. So, in U.S. v. Windsor, the Supreme Court said that the government must recognize, quote, the equal dignity of same-sex marriages. In other words, that it couldn't treat valid same-sex marriages as second-class citizens. And look, this is going to be the new frontier in terms of activism at the state level in trying to undermine the Obergefell decision. We've seen it in Texas. I want to flag. We're going to cover a case out of Texas that gives differential benefits to same-sex marriages as opposed to, you know, what heterosexual marriages, right? Like it I'm struggling to come up with a clarifier because we shouldn't have clarifiers, right? They should be marriages. Right. If we have legal marriage, legal marriage should carry with it the same benefits. This is an active front by the right wing right now, is to say, okay, well, you've got marriages, but, you know, we're going to make those separate but, quote, equal marriages. I continue to have tenuous optimism that the Supreme Court is not going to fall for that and that the fundamental principles that are at stake are sufficiently clear.
Yeah. Now I have another question, which is, if they had used American donors, would that have fixed it? I'm trying to think how this would apply. I guess it's still technically, by their definition, out of wedlock, even though I don't think that should be right. But
yeah,
technically speaking, out of wedlock. But if you have an out of wedlock birth abroad by two American citizens, how would that go down in their
By two American citizens, you'd be fine. Right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, if the donor, aren't the donors often like anonymous? Like, don't you usually? I mean, I'm just wondering how that plays into it. If they said, okay, well, the donor is an American citizen as well, so biologically, you know, like one. Oh, I guess you still have one parent who's not because it's the father. That's right. Sorry, never mind.
Right. No. It's that's okay. The point is that in 1401, which presumes a valid marriage, it says so long as either parent is a citizen, you can and the other.
Yeah, but I'm going on the premise that they're cheating a bit, right, and saying, oh, it's out of wedlock because the donor and the person aren't married.
Right. And if that were the case, then you trigger the provision that says now, for whatever reason. And again, look, this law was passed in 1952. So, who can, right? That's why we have the.
They
like,
definitely
very
didn't
archaic.
Intend for it to apply to this, you know, scenario. They were thinking, okay, someone out of wedlock has a child, just, you know, like the old fashioned way. They weren't, I highly doubt they had in mind in vitro fertilization.
Well, yeah, since it didn't exist, I'm sure they didn't. But interestingly enough, I looked up the legislative history, and in 1957, there's testimony in the congressional record that says the intent of the Immigration and Nationality Act, that is the act that gave rise to these provisions, was to provide for a liberal treatment of children and was concerned with the problem of keeping families of United States citizens and immigrants united. Hmm. And further, that Congress noted
how
that the
quaint
statutory
we used
language
to care about that in this country.
Makes it clear that the underlying intent is to preserve the family unit upon immigration to the United States. And let's be real clear about what this means. This determination means that if Andrew and Elad were to emigrate back into the United States, which they have every right to do, that the INS would say one of their children is allowed to come with them and to be a United States.
I don't
States
know,
citizen,
as you said,
the
there's no dictionary definition of breaking up the family unit more than, okay, you got twins, one of them citizen, the other not. Sorry.
And that's the case that we have. So I thought it was really interesting, and I wanted to flag that because when I am thinking about how you navigate eventually, I mean, I don't know that this case, obviously this is a district court complaint right now, so it's a long way from ever getting to the Supreme Court. But in thinking about how you might navigate the waters of a right-leaning Supreme Court with a center right justice in Anthony Kennedy, who's been very friendly to gay rights, I'm thinking, is there a potential narrow ground for affirmance? And the narrow ground for affirmance would be kicking the constitutional issue, is not saying Obergefell is the Brown versus Board of Education for marriages, right? Like,
well,
look, that's what I think the Supreme Court ought to say.
It shouldn't have anything to do with same-sex marriage, right? I mean, because if a heterosexual couple wants to do in vitro, or they have to do in vitro, and someone's abroad, you know, like I would think that they would still want their child to be a citizen.
Yeah, and I agree with that, but nobody would have standing to raise the claims on behalf of those people because INS isn't making that determination in heterosexual marriages. So you would argue that your discrimination stems, one, from the application, the selective application only to same-sex couples. And two, you could argue the inherent link is that same-sex couples are uniquely disadvantaged by the in-wedlock provisions inserting biological parents where obviously that provision is going to apply disproportionately and differentially to same-sex couples who can't biologically.
Yeah, true, but I'm just pointing out that it's not as though in vitro is an uncommon thing. I mean, there are plenty of heterosexual couples that have to use, you know, different techniques to get pregnant that would involve a donor. And I can't, that's what's weird to me is like, I don't even, as much as of course, I don't think this should be an issue at all. I don't see why it's an issue that even has to go so far as to extend to like same-sex marriage rights, other than of course you're saying the difference in how it's impacted. And I see that, but like, as far as the letter of the law is concerned, doesn't it impact both, gay couples and straight couples as long as they need in vitro? It's kind of the same, right?
And again, it would if this determination were being used to deny citizenship to heterosexual couples with children. But as far as I can tell, it has never been applied against heterosexual
But that's just them not doing their job consistently. Well, right?
But again, that's the core of how many of our equal protection cases get brought in this country, right? That is, the law says you have to treat A and B equally, and then in practice, you don't do that.
Okay.
So it's the easiest way to demonstrate discrimination is to say there's literally no difference. And I imagine that, that as the litigation develops, we will see the comparison to heterosexual couples that have had citizenship certificates issued in precisely this kind of situation, right? That's the first thing you're going to ask for. And again, remember that this is a private lawsuit, right? This is brought by the parents themselves, and that they're going to ask for discovery. I should add on top of it, we didn't do this in this complaint, the jump to the bottom. The plaintiff's lawyers in this case are Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell is my friends at Covington and Burling might say they're a little better, right? But it's a Covington and Burling firm, right? Like, it is a well-respected, long-established international mega law firm where all of the lawyers there are Ivy League law grads. And so this is not goofball lefty, lawyers with no experience. This is a real and serious case, and there is no doubt in my mind that they are going to run circles around the Trump administration lawyers who head to court to defend this policy. So I add that. So so many of our segments end with sadness, and I feel like this is going to end well.
Oh, well, okay. So this will just be sad in retrospect when you're wrong. Okay.
Thanks. Thanks.
We'll do an Andrew's. No, that's just my pessimism at the world, not you, Andrew.
No, fair enough.
No, thanks for the breakdown. Really fascinating case. I certainly absolutely hope that you're right and that there is a happy ending for this one. Seems straightforward that, twins should probably be the same citizenship status. That seems pretty straightforward. That seems like the no duh test should apply. But we'll have to tune in and see when there's updates and see if this goes the right way.
Absolutely.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
All right. Kevin Wright asks, there have been a few surprising decisions by some of the liberal members of the Supreme Court. Correct. I guess he's asked first. Step one, is that true? Have there been any surprising decisions by conservative members? Mainly wondering if the partisanship of the conservatives is as bad as it feels. Is it Kennedy? It seems like in the last 20 years, I thought that Republicans had been frustrated by the justices they had nominated then turning out to not be quite as Republican, but of course there is the Gorsuch, and there was Scalia, and there were plenty of hardcore right wingers. So I'm curious about this as well.
Yeah, I thought this was a great question, and I wanted to go back and do my best to see how this played out, sort of, you know, vis-a-vis our respective biases. And here's what I found. So first answers, I agree with the first two questions, right? So there certainly have been surprising decisions by the liberal members of the Supreme Court, most notably getting two additional votes from the left wing for the Trinity Lutheran decision, which we've excoriated at some length here. The decisions that immediately come to mind that are surprising to me by the conservative wing of the court, there were two that kind of immediately popped into mind. The first was obviously, I think, the most prominent in the past 10 years has been Chief Justice Roberts' vote in National Federation of Independent Businesses versus Sebelius. That was the 2012 decision that upheld the Obamacare individual mandate. That, I think, was a surprise, and I think led a lot of us, myself included, to say, okay, here's somebody that is not just voting along with a right-wing bloc. Here's somebody that is not a monolith. I would also flag, we talked about this in our episode 72 on racial gerrymandering, Clarence Thomas voting with the majority in Cooper versus Harris in striking down racially gerrymandered districts in North Carolina. Clarence Thomas, as it turns out, has a pretty clear and consistent record in upholding the Voting Rights Act when it comes to racial gerrymandering. He draws a sharp line between racial gerrymandering and his position, which is it is perfectly valid to gerrymander as badly as you want for political gerrymandering. But nevertheless, like, his colleagues on the far right also want it to be perfectly valid to gerrymander for racial reasoning. So I count those as sort of surprising decisions. But I wanted to dig in.
It's definitely surprising when a conservative isn't racist.
Gosh, sorry. This is not helping our cred in terms of reaching across the aisle here. I wanted to try and pull up some data. And as it turns out, a couple of different groups have put together some research. One was an NPR article. One was 538 that...
Ooh, I love 538's analysis of things
like
this.
Yeah, me too. Even though it's Nate Silver's.
Yeah, they try to quantify things that you wouldn't think you could sometimes. It's really cool.
Right. And so even though it's Nate Silver's fault that Donald Trump is president, I do too. And so as it turns out, study in July of 2017, so six months old at this point, what percentage of the time do you think that Justice Neil Gorsuch votes with the conservative wing of the court?
170%.
Yes, 100% of the time. Neil Gorsuch, in his as of then, right, and again, we've had an additional term, has not dissented from the right wing of the court.
Sorry, just to clarify, this was only since he's been at the Supreme Court, or even when he
correct.
Was
only oh, at, okay. only at the Supreme Court, right? That's what we're comparing. So not a huge
but
like. It being notable when Clarence Thomas asked a question off the bench for the first time in 20 years, it will be notable the first time Neil Gorsuch dissents from an opinion written by...
Don't hold your breath, everybody.
The right one. Yeah. And adding to that, I suppose this goes without saying, Neil Gorsuch has voted 100% of the time with Clarence Thomas, has never voted opposite Clarence Thomas up until Cooper versus Harris, which came out a month after that. So, and again, that's because Thomas was dissenting from the right. That case. Right. NPR says, if Thomas is Gorsuch's new best friend in terms of votes, his second best friend statistically is Justice Samuel Alito, with whom he voted the next most often. Those three, and sometimes just the two, represented the far right on the bench, while Roberts and Kennedy represented the center right. And so what they did was a kind of a cluster analysis. And it turns out that Roberts' votes are closer to Kennedy's than to Gorsuch, Alito, Thomas, only by a couple of percent. But that gives some additional evidence. I mean, it was something that caused me to kind of rethink, because I have included Roberts very often in the court's right-wing activist majority. I certainly think he has those tendencies, but it was interesting to me to see him dissenting from those from that group. And that's a longer, obviously, you know, the Chief Justice's tenure on the Supreme Court, you know, dates back over a decade. And that is a longer and more robust sample size. On the other side of the aisle, the numbers are lower, right? Mm. So, for example, the two most liberal justices by outcome are Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor. They vote together 78% of the time.
Jeez.
That's the highest correlation on the left. It's a lower correlation with Stephen Breyer and an even lower correlation with Elena Kagan. So this is another area. I love the question. It caused me to re-question some of my assumptions a little bit. It is not entirely monolithic, but I think my thesis remains true that the right wing of the court is politically monolithic and it is supported mathematically in a way that's not true of the left wing of the court.
Yeah, it really is asymmetrical warfare.
Yep.
Because, yeah. I mean, when you think about it, if there's one side that's pretty much always going to be united and then another side that has a more, you know, a bit more just statistically nuanced approach to being open to the other side, then it's like it's only going to disadvantage Democrats. Like there's going to be, you know, any conservative decision automatically has four justices or something, and then some of them will have even more support from the liberals, and it just doesn't go the other way.
Yeah, that comports both with the statistical analysis and with my view of the stated ideological and jurisprudential views of the justices. So there we go.
Well, that's depressing as always. but thanks
that's
for the
why
question.
People come back to this show. They come for the deep dive and the legal knowledge, and they stay for the
We need to start selling a
depression.
Cure, and then we'd be rich. You know, we've got the part where things suck, and it's we cover that. We just start if we only could market a pill or something that'll fix.
Yeah, we should. We could partner with our pals over.
Well,
at
you know
Placebo
what? No, I take it all back. I take it all back. The only cure is Yodel Mountain. Conspiracy ale, and we will at fine opening argument stores everywhere coming soon. So
there we go.
All right. Well, thanks for the question, and it is that time where we've got to thank our new patrons over at patreon.com/law. And a little bit quick, not so many this week. You know, hey, get on there if you want to get some of those bonus features, Q&A, and all that stuff. But we've got to thank Jacob Richard, Joseph Westfall, Maru Noir. And Christopher Hendricks, $5 pledge. Thank you so much, Christopher. Thanks a million to our new patrons. We really appreciate it, and hopefully you enjoy that Lot Awful Movies. By the way, as you pointed out, Andrew, the back catalog available to every patron. New ones, of course, available to $2 and up patrons, but hope you're enjoying that.
Yeah, thank you all so much for supporting us. And if you've ever thought about being a patron to Opening Arguments, if we're your go-to on your commute, you heard it. We're pretty light, and we couldn't continue to do this show without support from our listeners. So think about it. Head on over to patreon.com/law and see if you can't support the show.
Plus, you don't want to hear ads. Get the ad-free feed.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All righty, now it is time. Oh, man, once again, no confidence, but who knows? Maybe I lucked into this one. Let's talk Lord of the Rings here. How did I do on the Middle Earth Law?
So Middle Earth Law. This was the second question, which is: can John, the person who was hit by Ogre's arrow while being on his land, recover against Ogre for battery? And we had four answers. You eliminated B and C. And let's start off with your elimination of B. Because B said no, because the lightning was an intervening, superseding force. And I want to tell you, that's a good elimination. Mm. And in particular, I'm impressed because this is a really, really good attractive distractor. And it is, in fact, a principle of the law that we have previously talked about. So, for example, we talked about the Paul's Graf versus Long Island Railroad case.
Oh, yeah.
With the explosive and the train and the scale. It's a case that all law students always
but
remember.
I didn't, I mean, I didn't think of that, but I could pretend I did and say that this was not really that.
And indeed, this is not really that. the all lawyers, and that's why I think it's a good attractive distractor, because every lawyer remembers discussing Paul Scraff versus Long Island Railroad. And so you're sitting there going like, well, yeah, did these, this is kind of like lightning hitting, striking, causing a fire, causing the guy to shoot the arrow. That seems kind of the same thing. But the superseding
force.
Fortunately,
I'm too ignorant to think of all that. So I wasn't taken in by that.
Fortunately, you're too smart to have thought of that.
Ah, okay, sure.
Issues of superseding force like that, and the whole question of proximate causation comes up when we are discussing issues of negligence, right? Which was the case in the Long Island Railroad, which is a tort, a civil wrong between individuals. But this case is not a tort in negligence, right? Negligence is failure to abide by a standard of care. This is an intentional tort, right? When you were asking about battery, that is something that you do intentionally to someone.
Yeah. You know, because that was my only concern, is I thought there's a slight chance that because it was an accident, then maybe it would, you know, he would still, I think obviously John should still be able to recover, but maybe it would be some other tort. That was the only thing I was worried about.
Yep. So, it is the intentional tort of battery. And as you key in the answers, that means the question is, what is the intent that is required to be demonstrated in order to show the tort of battery? So you correctly eliminated B. I will continue to eliminate then as a result answer A, even though you kept it in as a live answer, but ultimately you didn't choose it. You said, which says that because John is a trespasser, he cannot recover against Ogre for battery. John was not a trespasser, right? He was privileged by necessity to be on Ogre's land. So
really, so all the stuff I said, so you do need to somehow know what's going on. Okay. Well,
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
And I would add, even if John had been a trespasser, we talked a little bit, right? Like you mentioned some state statutes.
Yeah, I want to know, how much of a libertarian wet dream is this? Can you shoot trespassers?
So the answer is, you can always, the bar exam asks common law doctrine, right? Unless it specifies otherwise. Yeah. You can supersede that by statute. And like we've talked about the Florida Stand Your Ground law and stuff like that. But at common law, when somebody is on your property, you have a common law right to use only the force that is, quote, reasonably necessary to remove the trespasser from your land.
Makes sense.
You look to the case law. I think, and I feel pretty good about that hiding and shooting an arrow is not consistent with reasonable force.
Yeah, he didn't try to communicate first or anything. He didn't try to, you know, get back or I'll shoot you and then, you know.
Right. And in fact, you know, a reasonable view of the fact pattern is that John was trying to get off the land anyway, right? Mm. So the amount of force that would be reasonably necessary to expel John from the land would probably not be sniping at him with an arrow. So then the question becomes C or D. You chose D. And D, the answer was yes, because John was escaping from the forest fire. And
That's C probably
is...
Wrong. That's probably wrong now that I think about it. But we'll
see. Yes, because Ogre intended to frighten him.
Yeah.
So D is not a fully wrong answer, but
it's not the most right answer. Yeah.
Correct. It would be marked incorrect on the bar exam because it's not the best answer.
Yeah.
Because it does not speak to the level of intent that's required. And the question is really asking you, do you know that in order to commit the intentional tort of battery, you do not have to intend the specific harm that was resulted, right? So in other words, the intent that that Ogre had here was to shoot an arrow near somebody, right? And that is imminent, what the law calls imminent harmful touching.
So then, but what happens if, this was just Ogre is doing some target practice. He just forget all the trespassing. He misses his target and it happens to just, you know, it glances off something and then it hits John.
There's no battery.
The
intent
but what
was,
is it?
I don't want to fully answer yet because there's a follow up question.
All right. Fine.
Right. So I don't want to prejudice you on question 13.
Fair enough.
Very good. Very good question. No. So in order to support the tort of battery, you have to intend to cause a kind of harm or imminent harm. And saying, I'm planning to shoot this real, real close to you is sufficient under the law if you miss and then hit, right? And think about that. I mean, the easiest way is, you know, suppose you say, all right, well, I'm just going to swing my fist real close to your face, and then you lean forward and I connect with your face.
Yeah.
Again, that's very clearly battery. So it was testing that specific provision. You didn't answer incorrectly. You just didn't pick the best answer.
No, I get it. I messed that one up. So that's on me, guys.
That's okay.
I'm profoundly disappointed in myself.
We can still go 2 out of 3 on the list, right? So.
Oh yeah, that's right. I did get the last one right.
Yep. So
that will be
the tipping point on this.
We'll have to find out then. Future Andrew, hop in your time machine and tell us which warlock got this Middle Earth question right. Middle Earth law. Hey, they don't, you know, there's not a lot of Middle Earth law. Trying to think. I've read Lord of the Rings, I don't know, 3 or 4 times. I don't remember. There's no court proceedings. They got to have, I mean, I guess there's some sort of justice alluded to in places, but
there's not a lot of due process at the top of
Tolkien
Mordor.
Tolkien missed an opportunity there for some real drama, some Middle Earth court drama.
Marvel did not, as we have mentioned from our Lord Awful movies. There are several Marvel superheroes who are lawyers. I love the fact that Matt Murdock was the Fantastic Four's lawyer. That is that's a shout out to our patrons.
So I think people are enjoying these multi-part bar questions, and in particular, this crazy setup. We had a lot of folks play along. A lot of great answers. People seemed about evenly split between C and D, but one of the first people to tweet at us with the correct answer was at NY and MU on Twitter, who says, C, because he attempted to frighten John, and your spooky bar question background music frightened me. That's a clear signal, Thomas, and shame on you for not seeing it. So, correct answer. I'm not sure that was a subliminal hint, but you keep doing whatever you got to do there, NY and MU. And everyone should give NY and MU a big shout out and follow on Twitter. That is at NYANDMU. Thanks for being this week's winner.
All right, well, that's it for today's show. Another disappointing performance by me on the bar, but that's okay. Thanks for the question, the participation. We always love it, and we're looking forward to that Q&A. See you fine patrons tomorrow. Everybody else, we'll, of course, see on Friday for another Rapid Response episode. Thanks so much for listening.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.